Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so it's Wednesday. You have to think by midweek, pretty much everybody has gotten in their takes on the Astros and the commissioner by now. I mean, everybody who's wanted to say something has said it by now, so we can all just move on, right? Everybody has gotten everything out of their system, and we can finally turn the page and move on to something else, right? Wrong. I'd love to say that's where we are, but we're not. There are still plenty of takes coming in, and plenty of people are still coming in hot, like Yankees slugger Aaron Judge.
Do you think the Astros should be stripped of their 2017 championship?
I just don't think it holds any value. You cheated and you didn't earn it. You know, that's how I feel, is it wasn't earned. You know, it wasn't earned the way of, you know, playing the game right and fighting till the end and knowing that, you know, we're competing, we're competitors. And the biggest thing about competition is laying it all out in the line, and, you know, whoever's the better player, better person, you know, comes out on top, you know, and, you know, you just lay it out there. And, you know, to know that another team had an advantage that, you know, nothing you can really guard against, that I just don't feel like that's earned, or, you know, yeah, it's not earned.
Honestly, I would love to move on to the next thing. I really would, but that's not happening. That obviously is not happening. And in terms of Judge, I know where he's coming from, and that's a really, really strong take. Or it would be if the Yankees themselves had not been in a gray area previously. And what I mean by that is this. According to a report from The Athletic last month, quote, as far back as 2015, the Yankees used the video replay room to learn other teams' sign sequences. Quote, unquote. And there was this, quote, by 2017, with rules governing electronic sign stealing still lacking the specificity that would come the next season, the Red Sox, Yankees, and Astros were all using their replay rooms to help decode sign sequences in some way, sources said, end quote. So, if you want to get into semantics and argue that the Yankees started doing that before the league issued that 2017 memo, we can certainly do that. And while I do not disagree with what Judge said, it would be a lot stronger coming from somebody else or another team that was not doing something similar to what has them so pissed off right now. But believe this, as it continues to unfold, there are definitely going to be some dudes in glass houses who are throwing gigantic boulders. And Judge was not the only guy going in on the commissioner yesterday. Far from it. Cubs pitcher John Lester picked up where Justin Turner left off, and he took a bat to Rob Manfred's comments about the World Series trophy being, quote, a piece of metal. Lester said, quote, that's someone that has never played our game. You play for a reason. You play for that piece of metal. I'm very proud of the three that I have. If that's the way he feels, then he needs to take his name off this trophy, end quote. Listen, we can have a serious debate about whether the commissioner handled the initial punishment correctly, but there is no debate that this weekend's interview that he had was an unmitigated disaster. In attempting to clean up a really bad situation, he somehow made it so much worse. In fact, he did the impossible. Manfred took a lot of the heat off the Astros and somehow put it on himself. If this guy were looking to fall on the sword himself, he executed that perfectly, except, you know, that was not the plan. Calling the World Series trophy, quote, a piece of metal.
Piece of metal.
Especially in this situation at this time, was an all-time bonehead move. You can't make that trophy. The thing that all these guys have spent their entire life grinding for and chasing. You can't take that and then call it a piece of metal.
Piece of metal.
Or a hunk of junk. Then you're just dumping all over the hard work that has been done to achieve it and disrespecting players who won that piece of metal.
Piece of metal.
Previously. And the players who busted their asses, their entire careers, their entire lives, and still somehow didn't get anywhere near that, quote, piece of metal.
Piece of metal.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the great Tom Crabtree. and the amazing tweet that he had back in the day. Quote, imagine you make a painting. It isn't perfect by other standards, but it's your painting. You are proud. Then somebody takes a bleep on it. End quote. Because in some players' eyes, Rob Manfred essentially just took a big dump on their trophy.
You'd have a big dump in
your... On your trophy.
You'd have a big dump...
On your trophy.
You'd have a big dump in your...
On your little hunk of metal. And Lester, man, he was just getting started. Quote, that's the first thing when people walk into my house. I take them to where my trophies are. I'm sure that hurt a lot of guys when they saw that, especially guys that haven't won it, that have been striving for years to try and get to it. I'm sure if Adam Dunn heard that, he played one playoff game in his whole career, he'd probably be pretty upset. It's a very, very special thing Manfred brought down significantly. End of quote. So do you think that guy's overreacting? I don't think so. Because the commissioner just took a big dump on their trophy.
You'd have a big dump in your
piece of metal.
Try it again, Alvin. You can do better. You got a big dump on your piece of metal.
You'd have a big dump in
piece of metal.
There you go, Alvin. Well done. And you know why this is not going to change or turn anytime soon? Because there might not be a sport that has more red asses than baseball. And I haven't seen these guys this red-assed about anything in a very long time, maybe ever. So if you're looking for this just to blow over and for everybody just to keep moving, you are looking at the wrong sport and the wrong group of guys. Because Lester again says no one is ready to move on yet, at least not the guys who weren't cheating. Quote, I don't think this is going to get brushed under the rug. Guys were disappointed that players didn't get punished. He's the boss, man. He makes those decisions. End of quote. Right. Not only is he the boss, not only does he make those decisions, but he just took a big dump on your hunk of metal.
You have a big dump in
piece of metal.
Again, as much as the Astros and the commissioner want this to be swept under the rug, there's exactly zero chance of that happening. Because, once again, there may not be a sport with more red asses per capita than baseball. A sport legendary for guys freaking out, F-bombing each other, and looking to fight if somebody is somehow too slow out of the batter's box on a home run, or if somebody rips a bag with a 6-run lead. So take that kind of vitriol that these guys typically spit after somebody goes bat flip or pimps a home run and then multiply it by infinity, and that's where we are right now. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. Much worse. How do I know? Because it's no longer just a baseball thing. How do I know? Because LeBron James just jumped into the cage with a weapon. He weaponized his Twitter feed, turning it into a blowtorch while attempting to burn the entire joint down. I wasn't there when he thumbed it out, but I would imagine that LeBron reached for his phone, cleared his throat with a, oh! And then thumbed out the following. Quote, listen, I know I don't play baseball, but I am in sports. And I know if someone cheated me out of winning the title and I found out about it, I would be bleeping irate. I mean, like, uncontrollable about what I would or could do. And he went on, and I quote, listen here, baseball commissioner. Listen to your players speaking today about how disgusted, mad, hurt, broken, etc. about this. Literally, the ball is in your court. Or should I say field? And you need to fix this for the sake of sports. Hashtag, just my thoughts. Coming from a sports junkie, regardless my own sport I play. I mean, holy crap. I'm not sure what's better. LeBron laying out how he'd be, quote, bleeping irate. Or LeBron lighting him up as, listen here, baseball commissioner. I'm going to go with the latter. Man, that is some all-time disrespect. Quote, listen here, baseball commissioner. Is amazing. Never has the term baseball commissioner been used as an insult like that until now. LeBron may as well have been saying, hey, old man, or maybe look here, little man. I haven't seen LeBron get that fired up on Twitter since he dropped a quote, you bum, back in the day. And no, that is not a green light for Bum Smack here. And no, I don't want any more emails from Irate Craig allegedly screaming, Bum Squad! It's Bomb Squad, not Bum Squad. Stay on point, clones. And back to LeBron. That's amazing. Honestly, that's a star athlete in one sport coming out of nowhere to destroy the commissioner of another sport because he's a fan of the game and he's pissed off by how the commissioner is handling it. And then telling him, quote, you need to fix this for the sake of sports. Hey, you got that, baseball commissioner? What's next? Lamar Jackson taking a run at the commissioner? Sid Crosby and Alex Ovechkin jumping on Facebook Live to smash the commissioner.
That's
right. Rory McIlroy taking to Instagram with a listen here, baseball commissioner. How about the winner of Wilder Fury 2 demanding to face Manfred in the ring next? At this point, none of it would surprise me. The commissioner is on the mound right now, and he's getting absolutely shelled. And there's nobody up in the bullpen. Nobody's getting warm. Nobody's coming to save this guy. His arm is hanging, he's getting rocked, and there is no help on the way. What I'm saying is, this dude better find a way to make a pitch or two to work out, or he's going to be out there a hell of a long time. Even dopey Bud Selig would have never handled this badly. In simplistic terms, Robert, the way you took a dump on your player's trophy, it is safe to say you, my friend, also have a big dump in your pants for how you handled this entire thing.
You have a big dump in your pants.
Let me take a moment and talk to you about Root Insurance. Now, what if good drivers did not have to pay for all the bad drivers? So Root developed a mobile app that measures driving behavior. By removing bad drivers from the equation, Root saved good drivers up to 52% in 2019. So gone are the days where your car insurance rate is based on your credit score, your age, your gender, your zip code. With Root, it's car insurance made easy, using an app to base rates primarily on how you drive. In other words, better drivers do deserve better rates. That's why the Root app uses driving behavior as the primary factor to determine car insurance rates. And in 2019, Root was the fastest growing direct insurance company in the United States. All you have to do is download the Root Insurance app, drive normally for a few weeks during the Root test drive, and then see how much money you save. Man, give it a try. Head on over to the App Store, download the Root Insurance app, and sign up in less than 1 minute and start your test drive right now. That's R-O-O-T, Root. Again, download the Root app right now or visit joinroot.com and learn more and see how much money you can save. Not available in all states. Disclaimers may apply. Visit joinroot.com for details. CJ Nikowski. CJ, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. And I feel exactly the same way you do. It's like, even for us, we're all, you know, all baseball channel when I'm doing radio. We're like, oh, let's get past it. But you can't. It's more and more keeps coming out, and there's more things that need attention.
But that's the truth, isn't it? So what do you make of how the last month has played out? I would love to get by, but we can't. What about the entire last month? What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's been pretty wild. I think that when the commissioner first came out with everything, I was pretty satisfied. I thought it came out pretty strong. Quite honestly, right? The year suspensions for Jeff Luhnow and for A.J. Hinch and then for Jim Crane to go on top of that and fire both of those guys was pretty fascinating. That one really blew me away. And it looked like Jim Crane was about to step in and say, you know what, enough is enough. Because they had a bunch of messes going back to the middle of last season, right? Justin Verlander wouldn't allow a reporter in the clubhouse. Then they had the thing during the postseason where you had the assistant GM that got fired for, you know, yelling at a couple of female reporters, and they just botched all of those. And it seemed like Jim Crane was over it, and he was dropping the hammer. And then he started to step on himself a little bit, and probably more than a little bit, when he was contradicting himself through his entire press conference. And the idea that, you know, these guys are saying that they're sorry, but they dig their heels in when it comes to talking about the postseason and us wanting to have the conversation about the World Series in 17 being tainted. They just will not relent on that, which has made it worse. But the biggest surprise in all this for me, Jim, is I've been shocked at how players have reacted. I mean, this player-on-player hate to a level that I certainly wasn't expecting. And as you mentioned, some big names, too, and some guys that don't talk very often. Like Mike Trout's pretty quiet. He talked about how upset he was. We heard Judge, you know, pretty straightforward guy. And then Nick Markakis saying that there was guys in that clubhouse yesterday that need a beating. I mean, that's all really shocking to see players come out, and Cody Bellinger as well. as strong as they have against Astros players.
CJ Nikowski joining us. So, CJ, why is that? Why are they so offended by that? Why do you think players are lashing out the way they are?
I think it probably has to do with some of the smugness that we have seen from the Astros players, right? There hasn't been a lot of contrite attitudes in what we've heard from these guys. And, you know, they've always been an organization that has a little edge to them. They're confident in what they do. I think the first couple of apologies from Alex Bregman and Jose Altuve at their fan fest did not go over well at all. I mean, it was almost as if, like, yeah, I know we got caught, but we don't care. And then they had those guys basically read for about 30 seconds in the press conference at spring training, and that wasn't really well received. And so I think that's the frustration there. And then the pushback on the postseason was a pushback on the idea that they didn't have that much of an advantage. I mean, the fact that Aaron Judge, I know it's so 2020, but the idea that he deleted a tweet congratulating Jose Altuve on winning the MVP back in 17, and he couldn't even have that up anymore. He was so disgusted. It's really amazing. But these guys feel cheated, and they're frustrated because you know, as far as these Astros players go, there really hasn't been anything that they felt outside of the pushback from fans and the pushback from some of their own within the game. But they're still going to get paid. They're still keeping rings. In the case of Jose Altuve, he's keeping an MVP trophy from 2017. And there really is no effect outside of a bad reputation.
CJ Nikowski joining us. I think you hit on the two key points for me, CJ. Number one, they don't seem like they're all that sorry. They don't seem like they're all that contrite. They're sorry they're in this position, but I'm not sure they're sorry what they did. And the other point is the commissioners tried to argue that the Astro players have already faced a punishment because their names are tied to this and their accomplishments have been tainted, even if they didn't get that title taken away. I mean, in your opinion, is that enough? Have they paid any price at all?
I mean, it'll be rough for them, but it should be much worse. You know, it's so interesting, man. Like, to see, first of all, we've seen in spring training, and they're already starting to hear it a little bit. And, you know, it even goes back to a part of, remember, Justin Verlander, of course, won the Cy Young Award and kind of joked a little bit about this whole situation when he received his award, which didn't go over really well.
He fell flat, right?
These things just keep kind of adding up. And listen, Alex Bregman could have won the MVP this year. You could have made an argument that he should have won it. That would not have gone over really well either. But so that's what's kind of led us to this point, and that they continue to kind of have these attitudes, man. It hasn't been great for the game, but this was a necessary evil, no doubt. But yeah, we have to try to have this conversation. It's tough to do, right? Like, what would they really do anything different? Like you said, are they really, really sorry? I mean, put yourself in the shoes of any of those guys. You still have your MVP. You still have your ring. In case of Jose Altuve, you still have your $168 million contract extension. Alex Bregman still has his $100 million contract extension. Nothing has really changed for them outside of that. You know, they took part in ruining a couple of careers in A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luhnow. We'll see how things bounce back over the next couple of years. I'm not overly optimistic for their GM, but maybe for A.J. Hinch, we'll see. But, you know, outside of that, they haven't really faced much. And I think the criticism they can handle because they get to keep all the stuff they really want.
Right. In other words, cheating does pay. I mean, it does. I'm not saying it's right. I don't condone it. But in that sense, it really does pay. Now, you've made the point that initially you were opposed to the idea of stripping or vacating the 2017 World Series title. But now you believe there's an argument that could be made for doing that. Can you break that down? What changed for you and what's the argument for it now?
Yeah, so you're listening to Rob Manfred talk about precedent. I kind of agreed. It seemed like it was taking it too far. I hate when we see that in the NCAA, and you certainly can't award it to another team. You can't automatically give it to the Dodgers. But the more people that I've listened to, and the more I've seen this thing kind of unfold and the real anger for the players, suspensions were never a real thing. They were never a possibility. I know people are frustrated, but it just wasn't a reality in this investigation. I mean, players were going to get suspended. So what could really hurt? And based on it, going back to the way that Jim Crane, from the very top to the bottom, Jim Crane, the owner, and then all the way down to that clubhouse, everyone has dug in and said, no, it didn't affect the World Series. You know how important it is to them. And it's important to this franchise because, you know, they went through that rebuild. We all kind of laughed at them a little bit, like, what are the Astros doing? And they were justified in their actions because they won a World Series. Okay, you know what? You've got to take them seriously. What they did actually worked, and they kind of got the last laugh. Well, you take that away from them, and all of a sudden that legacy of this new group of Astros, and I know their GM's gone anyway, so it's going to feel different going forward. But all of a sudden, that entire thing is shot. And, you know, for these billionaire owners, man, I mean, it's you know, these owning an organization, I mean, it's, you know, first of all, it's tough to come by. And this is kind of like your toy, your point of pride. These guys have been successful in so many other areas of business, but you cannot buy a World Series ring, right? Your team has to go out there and earn it, and everything has to come together. And you can have the nicest watch and the nicest car and the sweetest pad, you know, vacation pad, but that World Series ring that you get to bring to your other billionaire buddies, they can't have one. They can't get one. And the idea of telling the Astros that they have to give it back. Not to get the physically give the rings back, but that is, that would be vacated. To me, since it's a bigger message that I didn't think needed to be sent, but based on all these reactions, and I don't think we'll see it, but it's probably the only one that actually would get through at this point.
CJ Nikowski joins me for another few moments. CJ, what about this notion of pitchers retaliating against the Astros on the field? What's your reaction when you hear that, and how likely is it, and to what extent do you think it'll be?
Yeah, you got to be careful. I know that once you have the uniform off, you have a tendency to think a little bit more clear-headed than when you have it on. And there are some guys that are really upset. There's been guys that have been pretty outspoken about that fact. But the commissioner's trying to get out in front of it. Will we see it? Probably. I don't think we're going to see it a ton. And as much as I'm as angered and frustrated with the Astros as everybody else, it's not necessarily the right way, in my opinion, to go out and start targeting a bunch of these guys. And, you know, the idea of guys getting hurt or having career-ending injuries, taking a fastball up too high, doesn't change anything. And I don't think that's necessarily the proper retaliation. We'll see it, I think, a couple of times. So now we're going to see whether or not or how both the umpires and then eventually Major League Baseball try to judge intent. Right, that's the hardest thing. I mean, the Astros were hit 66 times last year. The Mets led all of baseball with 95 hit by pitches. Like, guys are going to get hit. What I don't want to see happen is some, all of a sudden starters roll into Houston or any pitcher for that matter, and they feel like they got to be careful throwing inside because they don't want to get kicked out of the game. Like, if there's a pitcher that's kicked out of the game because he hits a guy in the second inning and there was no intent behind it, then that manager's going to go crazy. I mean, he's going to lose his mind. He's going to get ejected as well. And so it's going to be a balancing act, and hopefully Major League Baseball will lean on the side, at least in-game, that it wasn't intentional and that they need to kind of sift through it after the fact, and they do. I know Dusty Baker's worried about it. He's already brought it up. But there'll be some incidents this year, no doubt.
Hey, listen, I think this is such a key point that you just made. I mean, can you imagine if people right now are already so frustrated and so angry, and then it's let – the point is made that you cannot come inside, or they think they can't come inside because of what's gone down. Does that not give Houston an advantage all over again?
Exactly. And for any hitter, right, they'll tell you if they only have to worry about one side of the plate, just like knowing what pitch is coming, that's a huge advantage. And so, you know, it happens anyway, even in these situations that are different than how obviously extreme this one is, where sometimes umpires feel like there was an intentional hit by pitch, and it really wasn't, right? It was just a guy trying to work the inside of the plate, and it got away from him a little bit. And that's why I say judging intent is one that really bothers me. My favorite thing to watch, which I didn't really think too much about today, it's really incredible that the All-Star game is going to be in Los Angeles this year at Dodger Stadium. I mean, and at least one Astro has to be there. I'm really curious to see how they'll do in the voting this year. And Dusty Baker, of course, a former Dodger, has to manage that team. He doesn't get to pick. They got rid of that rule where the manager gets to pick some of his own players. That's over with. But the idea that there could be some Astros suiting up this year in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium for the All-Star game could be pretty amazing.
That is going to be fascinating. CJ, one last thought. Because you're a broadcaster with the Rangers, you don't travel with the general public as much as you used to, but there's no way that you come on here and I don't ask you something about etiquette. You tweeted recently that the most famous person you ever sat next to on a plane was CeeLo Green. How did that go? And more importantly, how was his travel etiquette?
It was pretty good. So he had the window and I had the aisle. It was an overnight. It was a red-eye flight from Atlanta to New York. When I used to work in L.A., that Atlanta to New York flight, it was pretty steady. Atlanta to L.A. It's not Atlanta to New York, but a decent amount of celebrities because there's so much going on in Atlanta these days and so much filming. And so I'd always see a handful of celebrities when I took that flight pretty consistently. But, you know, one thing that my wife had said to me, and always, and I had to look when I was there, she's like, you ever notice how small his hands were? Like, she had said that to me before I had sat next to him, and I couldn't help. I was trying not to stare. But his etiquette was off the charts. He was actually really nice and friendly, and nothing but good things to say about CeeLo Green and our, not that he remembers it, but our 5.5 hours together.
I love it. A 10-year MLB vet, 9th pick overall in 94. He is a broadcaster for the Texas Rangers. He is a host on MLB Radio and, again, America's foremost authority still on travel etiquette. CJ, I appreciate you. Great to have you back, and thank you for always doing the show.
You got it, Jim. Take care, man. Have a great day.
No, bro. The commissioner did not orchestrate this. It's an all-time bad take. 1-800. Yeah, look, I'm not trying to discourage you from calling. Just don't call with bad takes. No, he totally jacked this whole thing up, and he's been getting dragged every single day for it. And the sport looks terrible. And others from outside the sport even are rushing in like LeBron to hammer them for the way they've handled this. No, it's not a good thing. This is not a case of any publicity is good publicity. This is really bad publicity. They've got no vision. It's a bad thing. It's a bad thing. Man, did that call really happen? Did I really have to exert that kind of energy to answer like that? Oh! Anybody else? You know when I said that I guaranteed I would take phone calls this segment? I take it back. I lied. I don't want to risk getting another phone call like that. You're not a felon, but I am a liar. I am not a felon. I'm not even a misdemeanorian. I didn't commit any crime, but I did lie. I did lie when I said that I would take a phone call or two. I did lie when I said I would take multiple phone calls because there's no way in hell I'm taking another phone call this segment after that phone call. I do want to talk about the Astros getting heckled, though. Let me start that thought really quickly. So their position players did report to camp in West Palm Beach. And so have the hecklers. It's not like we didn't know this was coming, but it didn't take very long. Maybe you think that the Astros might be in a safe spot at their own spring training facility, but probably not when you consider they share that facility with the Nats. And they're not in H-Town. They're in Florida. So all that hometown love, if there's any left, is going to have to wait until they actually get home. Because yesterday, a couple of different hecklers went to the most obvious heckles that these guys are going to get all year. I think most athletes respect a good heckle, as long as it's creative. These were not. The first one came when Jose Altuve was running from the clubhouse to the field. A dude was posted up on the other side of the fence and then nuked him with a cheater blast.
Cheater!
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 0 points for creativity, but 10 points for execution. There's no way that Altuve did not get every bit of whatever that guy's breath smelled like, because that dude put that cheater scud
cheater
right in his ear hole.
Cheater!
And at a Spinal Tap level of volume. Nobody who saw or heard that is wondering if Altuve had any trouble deciphering what that guy said. Nobody who saw or heard that wondered if Altuve saw or heard that. He did, loud and clear. Not exactly the Boogie Cousins hecklers, but then again, who is?
Tee him up, ref! Come on, ref, tee him up. That's a delay of giving.
Hey, ref, do your job, man. Come on.
Hey, Alvin, why is Boogie so fat?
Tee him up.
Tee him up, ref!
Hey, D, what's good, baby? Hey, AD was just staring at y'all.
That's just what happened, fat boy? Fouled out?
Cousins, what's good?
Baby, heal it. Baby,
fat boy, how many you got, baby? What's good, fat boy? Fat boy! Fat boy!
Donuts, baby, donuts!
Fat boy!
We got donuts!
I'm telling you, I've never been more riveted by that than I was right there. If you listen really carefully, and I've got a couple of earbuds so I could hear everything going on, there are multiple guys just going in and on. I don't even think you pick up all the brilliance of that. These guys are laughing at themselves. Donuts. They're like measuring their blast before they actually get them off. A baby Huey blast in there. AD, what's good? Like, they weren't even coming for AD. Like, they respected AD. What's good, baby? What's good, AD? We need more of that. Those guys are legendary. Maybe I'm the only one who thinks so. These dudes better get used to being called cheaters, though. I just hope it gets a little more creative than that. It's happening before they even take the field for minute one of day one of spring training. If that's the case, we're going to get 8 more months of that. I just hope it gets more creative than that, because yesterday it didn't. There was more of that, but it was not any more creative than that. I need you to do better, because if it's happening before they even take the field for minute one of day one of spring training, we're going to get more of that for the next 8 months. It's got to be better. The other heckle that you know is coming early and often is somebody or somebody's banging on a trash can. Banging a trash can to heckle the Astros would be the equivalent of showing up to a football game in a ref's costume with a blindfold and a white cane. It's so obvious and so lacking in any subtlety or creativity or intelligence. I mean, it really borders on lame and tired already, and the season hasn't even started yet. But sure enough, somebody was able to smuggle in a trash can yesterday from the front row behind home plate, and it's going to be tougher to do that in the regular season. But somebody was able to do so yesterday while Altuve, Alex Bregman, and Carlos Correa were in the cage for BP. Here is the absolutely captivating audio. Awesome. I guess the best part of that particular episode of Trash Can Banging is that the reporters who saw it said the guy took off running after those 11 bangs. Check it. You know, like bang, 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 run, bolt, bounce, run, sprint. Like this dude thought that he pulled the pin on a grenade and then ran. Or intentionally did not pay the bill at the restaurant and ran. I love the idea of some dork bringing a trash can, going to the trouble to load up a trash can, bringing it to the yard, banging on it 11 times, and then running away as if somebody was in hot pursuit when nobody was. Like, tell me this guy had to have a getaway driver. What, Ding Dong Ditch didn't want any of that? Dine and Dash did not want any of that? Imagine some tool with a trash can between his legs, in the stands, clubbing it for like 5 seconds, and then darting like he just robbed a bank or a liquor store. Like he just pulled up something that would have cops in the air looking for him. Dude probably ran right to Walgreens, grabbed some bleach, threw it in his lettuce, shaved, bought a pair of sunglasses, changed his name, glued on a fake goatee, booked a flight out of the country, and then turned on the news when he landed in Mexico to see if the feds were looking for him. All the while, no Astros turned around. Nobody seemed to notice the banging except a few reporters who had nothing better to do. Now, me ripping the hecklers is not me defending the Astros. Far from it. Don't get that twisted. I'm just saying, I know you're going to heckle them. If you're going to heckle them and spend the next 8 months doing it, get more creative than showing up to the yard and screaming, "Cheater!
Cheater!"
Or bringing some trash can to the yard, hitting it a few times, and then running. Doesn't even sound like a trash can. Trash can hit and run. You gotta do better than that. I know this was the day that many people were waiting for. Day one of an 8 month long hate tour for the Astros. I just need to see a better effort. I need to see more creativity. I need to see better heckles. I don't want to have to do your work for you either. Do it yourself and do better. If this is what we're looking at for the next 8 months, it's going to get real boring real fast. It already is. Mark Pope is my guest. Mark, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Man, hey, I'm so hyped to be on the show, my friend. So my entire forgettable NBA career, I got to listen to your show. So in that sense, I felt like we had to grow up together, man. It's very cool. So
Mark, that is so great that you just said that. Number one, because I want to talk to you. I'm going to get you to stop talking about your, quote, unforgettable NBA career. You and I can get into that. But I'm just as eager to talk to you.
I didn't say unforgettable. I said forgettable.
Forgettable. All right, I want to get into that. I don't want to start there. I just want to say it's just as good to have you on this show as it is for you to be on the program. I've been looking forward to it myself. Let me talk to you about your team first. You're coming off back-to-back road wins over Loyola Marymount in San Diego. You've won six straight. You're back in the top 25 for the first time since 2010, 2011. How is life around your program right now?
It's good right now, but you know, we're coming down the stretch, right? So it's there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of urgency. And we understand what lays in the balance of every single night we step on the court. And So we're feeling all the juice that you want to feel in February heading into March. I mean, we're exactly where we hope to be, and we know how big every single game is right now.
BYU head coach Mark Pope is my guest. Now, as a team, you have put up some serious numbers this year. You're number one in the nation in three-point field goal percentage. You're second in three-point field goals per game. You're third in field goal percentage, assist per game, assist to turnover ratio. I can go on. That's a level of great efficiency that most coaches only dream of. How have you gone about reaching those levels?
Well, it starts with good players. It's always 99% of it. We have really good players that have been really, really dedicated to kind of refining their craft in terms of developing not only their stroke, but also learning about, where they're most effective on the floor, and also guys working really hard to earn great shots for each other, right? Our team has really bought into that and really been committed to that. But it's been a joy to watch and coach for sure.
We're talking to Mark Pope. Now, Mark, you had been an assistant at BYU under Dave Rose. Because of the success that you had at Utah Valley, your name came up for a number of high-profile jobs. What was your reaction when the opportunity came up at BYU?
Well, I had a lot of emotion because, in this coaching business, everybody always says you never follow John Wooden, ever, right? That's career suicide, and Coach Rose was certainly that. I mean, he did it better than anybody's ever done it here at BYU, and I got to work under him, and he is a tough act to follow, so that's a daunting prospect. But I also had been here and had been able to see firsthand how extraordinary this place is. In some ways, I know it sounds crazy, in some ways it's the best kept secret in all of college basketball, and I think here we actually have the opportunity to do things that maybe sometimes we get scared of even saying out loud, but I think this is a special place, and so I couldn't be happier to be here.
Now, Mark, I know that must be an amazing place. For you to say something like that about BYU when you played at Kentucky and you won a national championship there really speaks to how different, how unique, how special BYU is. In fact, you talked about one of the things that you like to do is, quote, chase discomfort. Where does that approach come from, and what do you like about chasing discomfort?
That's interesting. I think probably all of us, right, as athletes, and you don't have to be an athlete. Then you do. You kind of grow up, and as you're trying to excel and trying to become good at something, you're just thrown in all kind of uncomfortable situations, and you don't like it. But then over time, it almost becomes addictive, right? When you chase discomfort, it means you have a chance to grow. When you have chase discomfort, it means you actually have a chance to do something special. When you chase discomfort, it means you have a chance to do something people don't think you can do, right? And so if you're living in discomfort, then that means that you have a chance to actually accomplish something. And so it's something we talk about a lot here. It's part of what we do. I got to play for the legendary Rick Pitino, and so he inflicted so much discomfort every single second of the day. That we got used to it and became a little addicted to it. And it was a gift to every single one of us that got to play under him.
What an amazing response that is. So I would imagine if I were to say to you physical discomfort or mental discomfort or emotional discomfort, your response would be yes, right? All the above.
Yeah, 100%. The physical discomfort, as awful as it is, it's actually not as fatiguing, I think, as the emotional and mental discomfort. I think that's what sets guys apart. The guys who can actually manage that part of it, I think those are the teams that can actually become special.
We're talking to Mark Pope. Now, in terms of chasing discomfort, in the first month of the season alone, you played San Diego State, Houston, UCLA, Kansas, Virginia Tech, and Utah. That is a monster schedule. I would argue that is chasing discomfort. What did you learn about your team during that first month? And then how much does that set you up for the rest of the season?
Well, we learned a lot about our team. We learned that I have a really good team and I'm not a very good coach. We also learned a lot because we played that stretch without Yoli Childs, who is our, is our returning, 20-10. Like, he's a guaranteed 20-10 every single game. And what these guys accomplished during that stretch didn't only change our team, the guys that were playing, it also changed Yoli. Like, he got to grow so much, and he got to believe so much in what this group could do without his help And so when he jumped on, we had this incredible continuity in this respect going on both sides that I think has helped us so far. Now, we still got a lot of work to do, but in the end, it turned out to be a real blessing. The hard schedule and doing it with a limited roster, both those things have helped us along the way.
BYU head basketball coach Mark Pope is my guest. All right, let's go back to your, quote, forgettable NBA career. You know, you had that national championship mark at Kentucky. You played in the NBA for a number of years. Not only have you said that it's a forgettable career, I've actually heard you say that you were the worst NBA player ever. Also not true. I'm not buying that. But you were with the Pacers when Larry Bird was the coach. The story goes that he would shoot with you and talk with you about life and basketball. What was that experience like?
Oh, come on. Come on. I mean, Jim, I'm telling you, you know, for a bad young player that grew up, you know, just idolizing Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. You know, seriously, I was the biggest NBA fan in the world, and I actually got to wear a jersey. And then to have that time with Coach Bird, where, you know, coaches, he is not an open book, as you know, right?
Sure.
He's not a talker, and he's really pretty reserved. And to have that time where I think he's the most brilliant basketball mind on the planet. I really do. Getting to play for him for a couple of years and watch how he orchestrated that. But to have those times where he actually jumped in and we got to play shooting games alone in the gym at night, and he would be talking smack, it was so unbelievable. Because I grew up watching him and cheering for him. It was such a gift, man. I was really blessed.
Mark, one more thing about that. In your second season, he did call you into his office, and he had to tell you that he was waving you. You told Seth Davis, quote, it was one of the worst moments of my whole life. But then you also added, quote, man, I treasure it. What did you treasure about that moment?
I don't know if I'm probably going to butcher it. I don't know if I have the right words for it, but you know, when you pour your heart and soul into something, which certainly I had to do to try and stay alive in that league, it's the kind of commitment and sacrifice that nobody really knows except for the individual that's making it. And it was so awful. I mean, we had just finished practice. It was just before, we were starting the season, so training camp was essentially ending. And he called me in he told me, and of course I start immediately crying because I'm just ridiculous like that. And so I can't cry in front of Larry Bird. So I just shook his hand real quick and ran out of the office. And it's in the new Conseco Fieldhouse. At the time it was Conseco. And you run right out of it wasn't his office, it was just a little room, right out and run right in the locker room. And there's Reggie and Mark Jackson. And I can't get the tears out of my eyes. Man, it was just humiliating and awful. But who gets that? And I'm saying this seriously. Like, I'm so proud of the fact that I got to get fired by Larry Bird, right? And I got to be in the game. And then, you know, the thing that Coach Bird told me at the time, he's like, Mark, and we he had been really generous in terms of having a relationship with me. And so he told me at the time, he's like, Mark, you actually need to fire you for you. This is going to be the best thing for you. And sure enough, a year later, I'm starting for the Milwaukee Bucks in the only part of my career that really I had made any contribution, and Coach was right, and so it was beautiful for the sense of who I got to share that awful experience with, and then it was beautiful for what followed.
Yeah, that is not a butchered attempt at a story. That is an incredible story. Mark Pope is joining us. That is an amazing story. I could end that right there, and we could walk off on that, and that would be amazing. But there was another aspect of your career and your life that's amazing to me, Mark. At one point, you took the medical school entrance exam. After your time with the NBA was over, you applied to Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, and you were accepted. Just so people know, Columbia admits roughly 4.5% of the applicants to the College of Physicians and Surgeons. You were in the most elite of company. What was your time in medical school like?
It was so awesome and so humbling and so kind of, as you go through life, you kind of get these experiences where you find out who you are and where your real passions lie. And so, you know, it's one of the great things about being a really bad NBA player is that you spend every day wondering what you're going to do when you can't get another job. We just were lucky enough to do it for 10 years, right? And so, you know, ultimately we settled on going to medical school, and so we went, and I had an extraordinary experience all the way up until, I dropped out just before I was, just at the completion of my third year to go take a job with the great Mark Fox at University of Georgia, who'd been a good friend for a long time. But, going to school taught me a lot. The most important thing it taught me, which was surprising to me because I didn't think it when I was a player, but I just missed the game so much, and I missed being with a team so much and being around this incredible game. And so that's a gift to have as a coach, because our lives are they're very dynamic and uncertain, and sometimes they can be hard. And so if you're going to coach, you better know for sure that it's what you were born to do and the only thing you can do. And that's what I learned, is that this is what I want to do more than anything else, and it's been a gift ever since.
So, Mark, one quick follow. Before you accepted that job, the story goes you had to have a meeting with the dean of the Columbia Medical School. How did that meeting go?
I mean, Dean Melman, I love her. She's been so fantastic to me. So I walk in her office, and I sat down, and I tried to explain to her that I was going to go take a bad coaching job, not even an assistant coach. I had to go as a assistant director of operations, really, at the University of Georgia. And she was like, "You have lost your freaking mind." I mean, she couldn't believe it. It was like the dumbest thing she'd ever heard in her life. She's been super supportive. We've actually kept in touch since, and she's an extraordinary human being. Man, she's amazing. I think, she probably put that on her list of the meetings that were most surprising to her.
So let me ask you something. I can't play a lick. I'm old enough to be your dad. I've got no eligibility, but can I come there and play for you?
Let's go, man. Come free. Hey, we're taking all comers,
This is so good. BYU 21-7. They're in 23 in the AP poll. They're hosting Santa Clara tomorrow night right here on CBS Sports Network. How you and I did not do this sooner than today, Mark, I have no idea. But that was an absolute blast.
Well, hey, listen, it's really a privilege to be on. I'm telling you, like, there's not that many voices that you kind of run through with your life, but it sure has been fun listening to you over the years, man. You do an unbelievable job for sports, so thanks for having me on.
He is Troy Polamalu. Troy, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me back on your show, Jim. I appreciate it.
Troy, it's so great to have you back on the show, and I appreciate you doing it. It's been a few weeks since the announcement of the Hall of Fame class. So how does it feel to be introduced as a member of the class of 2020 and to know that you are, in fact, going to Canton?
It was really special experience to be there at the Super Bowl, to be close with the other enshrinees. Obviously, with Coach Cower going in there and being able to be around him quite a bit as well. A lot of the former Steelers came back, Joe Green, Franco, Mel Blount. So it was really Rod Woodson. So it was great to see them down in the Super Bowl. It truly is an honor. It feels great.
Troy Polamalu is my guest. I'm not surprised, Troy, to hear you answer it like that, because when you and I spoke back in December, you talked about how you were indifferent to individual honors like the Hall of Fame because football is the ultimate team sport. Knowing that, how much do you feel, or how does it feel to represent all of your teammates the way you will be when you go into the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, so for me, that's really what this award is about, is a tribute to my teammates, especially with the philosophy that we carried internally within the organization I've been a part of. And so being able to play for Coach LeBeau, being able to play for with great teammates as well. I mean, I was really just one of 11 players out there. So definitely have been fortunate to be part of not only a great team, but great defense and great legacy.
Troy Polamalu, my guest. I'm so glad you mentioned Dick LeBeau, Troy, because he raves about you as a player and raves that you were a coach's dream. How would you describe your relationship with him and what he meant to your career?
Definitely like a father figure to me. Definitely to a lot of my teammates, a lot of the players that he hadn't coached, for the Steelers as well, from the Bills to even back in the day with the Bengals. So everybody's kind of had this relationship with Coach LeBeau. He's a very special person, one of the most amazing people in the NFL. So was very fortunate to play for him.
Troy Polamalu is a Pro Football Hall of Fame inductee, class of 2020. You know, one more thing about LeBeau, he talks about the chemistry that you had with Ryan Clark and Deshae Townsend. First off, what was it like, Troy, playing with those two?
Awesome. You know, those guys within themselves are geniuses of the game as well. So to be able to innovate, you know, kind of how we played the defense, innovate kind of how defense was played, you know, holistically throughout the league, I think was a great thing that we've been able to do, and how, you know, we were able to change different defenses, make defenses look differently. And Coach LeBeau gave us the freedom to kind of innovate within his scheme. So it was really great.
We're talking to Troy Polamalu. Troy, I want to read you a quote from Tom Brady. Now, Tom Brady said this in the build-up to the Hall of Fame, and it's going to take me a minute to lay this out, but this is a really amazing quote. He said, "One key to success for a quarterback is to study a lot of film in order to understand defensive tendencies and know how the defense will try to defend everything you're trying to do as an offense." But that never worked against Troy. He was one of the most instinctive and disruptive players I have ever played against. Outside of his incredible athleticism, his greatest skill was his unpredictability. You could never quite get a bead on what he was doing, yet he was always around the ball." End of quote. That's a really, really strong bit of praise. What does it mean to you to hear that from Tom Brady?
It's funny. As I could tell, I was getting older as I was playing, because the more and more I would see these great players, you know, that I was competing against, I started to become impressed, you know, with myself. I'd be like, wow, I can't believe I play against Tom Brady. I can't believe I play against, you know, Calvin Johnson and Adrian Peterson and all these guys. I really became big fans of not only them as football players, but just as pure athletes. So to even hear them say that to me is obviously very humbling, but it's really great, because I think when you start to play this game, the thing that you want to do is first earn the respect of your teammates, but then, you know, hopefully you can become successful enough to earn the same respect from your opponents as well. So to hear him say something like that is definitely humbling and a blessing.
I would imagine, Troy, that as a gladiator and a competitor, you probably cherished those great battles. Like, specifically, what was it like to go up against Brady? What were those chess matches like?
Probably like most chess matches that he's had or they've had in New England, you know, the winning end most of the time. It's great, because every time, you know, that you're going to play against the Patriots or the Ravens or, you know, a lot of these really successful organizations, you're always going to have to bring your A game, and everybody's always going to be watching. And anytime you have that opportunity to play on those Monday night games, just games that are truly meaningful in the scheme of Super Bowl or big games that have to leverage a lot, you know, these experiences are great. They really are great experiences. They're emotionally involved, and it's awesome.
We're talking to Troy Polamalu for a few more moments. You know, Troy, you mentioned Bill Cowher and the fact that you're going to go in with him as well. You know, because I work on the NFL and CBS, I've spent some time the last few years with Bill Cowher. He's an amazing person. He is such a good guy and so interesting and a great leader and a great worker. I think everybody who works around him and spends time with him gets so much out of that. I know you would say the same thing about everybody you've been around with the Steelers, but what about Cowher? In your mind, what makes him different, and what was it like for you to spend time and work alongside him?
Man, I think one of his great qualities, and I've been fortunate to have two great head coaches, you know, for the Steelers. So with Coach Cowher, I think one of his great assets and skill sets is that he really allows each player, each individual to really be the best versions of themselves. And, you know, I think that he gave a lot of diverse personalities, and the way that he kind of saw it, he kind of saw himself as a father, as I've heard him quote, of, you know, 53 young men. So for me is to be able to manage all of these young men and to be able to let them be themselves within this, you know, blue collar culture that he had said, and these diverse personalities really just come together. And I think that's really what his great skill set is that he let everybody be themselves, the best version of themselves, and brought everybody collectively together.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Troy. So having said that, then you got Mike Tomlin, who goes about it a very different way with a different kind of personality. Like, what does he bring to it? What makes him unique? And why do you think he's had success the way he has in Pittsburgh?
Well, it's really interesting. I think when you look at, you know, just culturally, socially for our country and the way that it shifts with, you know, the way the young millennials is a much different generation than even the generation that I've been a part of. I think Coach Tomlin has done a real great job of managing, you know, this younger culture moving up through a very traditional sport. So the way that he's been able to reach players is very similar to how Coach Cower has been able to reach players as well. I think Coach Cower definitely had much more of an advantage because he's from Pittsburgh. You know, he embodies that blue culture, that blue collar culture. But for Coach Tomlin, I just think that for him, I think his great asset too is being able to manage this young millennial culture and whatnot.
You bet. Troy Polamalu, my guest. So a final thought, Troy, I know for you it's always going to be about the people around you. It's going to be the people you played with, the people you played for. But has it sunk in, and do you have any idea what it's going to feel like to actually be inducted into the hall in August? Any idea what kind of emotions you might be feeling when that time comes?
No, you know, it really is a great honor. But it's nothing that I feel that, you know, something that I really sought after or helped define. I think if it defines anything, it really defines, you know, what my teammates and myself have been able to do together. But it's nothing I think that carries really a lot of personal weight for me. But I don't know. Maybe things may change. I know that when I was there in you know, Miami for the Super Bowl, just being able to see all the other great Hall of Famers that have been such huge roles within the development of the game of football, you know, I just felt really unworthy to be on that stage, to be quite frank, because I mean, these guys were titans of the game. And not only that, is they really came through a period of time where football, you know, needed them. So, you know, football has much different role, I think, in the game and culture today than it has in the past. So for me to just, you know, be accepted on the same scale as them is, you know, like I said, humbling.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Troy. That's going to be my final question, because the people who came before you, so when you saw them the week of the Super Bowl, who were some of the guys that you sought out and had conversations with? I would imagine many of them feel the same way about you that you feel about them. Who were some of the people you talked to? What were the conversations like with some of the guys who were already in that you're going to be joining?
Well, for me, obviously, being drafted to the Pittsburgh Steelers, the number one respect that I really wanted to make was really, first of all, from my teammates. But then after that, if I knew that I'd be doing something really good if I was able to earn the respect of the Joe Greens, the Mel Blunts, you know, these other former Steelers, because I didn't have to, like, look outside of our organization to really validate, you know, who I was as a football player, because I literally had, you know, the greatest defensive backs or greatest defensive linemen or greatest players generally, you know, that were showing up every day, you know, to our facility. So to me, that was just a very, very special experience to be part of that organization and just really find value through, you know, through those old guys that would come back.
Troy, it's so true. Like, even as a kid, when I was growing up in Los Angeles, of all things, I was actually a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. So the guys you mentioned, like defensively, Mel Blount, Donnie Shell was absolutely amazing. The linebackers like Jack Ham, Jack Lambert, Andy Russell up front, L.C. Greenwood.
Yeah,
I mean, amazing, amazing defensive players.
Would come back and often visit.
What was that like?
It was, it's really humbling, you know, especially when you see a guy like Mel Blount, who's 6'5 and 6'6, and you're like, wait, you're a lockdown corner
right.
in the 70s? You know, so I had thought at first that he was a defensive end. So
when
you see, like, these great titans of the game, man, that are able to come back and really impart their knowledge, or you can just feel, you know, the sense of football greatness as they come back to Southside all the time. That is such a great reminder of where we stand, you know, in this whole football world. But to see those guys, you know, in Miami was really awesome. And I think on the other side of things too, I thought was cool is to see Anthony Munoz, you know, and Ronnie Lott, other guys from USC that I also looked up to. That were great titans of this game as well. So to me, Bruce Matthews was there. So to me, it was really a humbling all around experience from the Steelers, from USC.
I'm trying to let you go, Troy, but you mentioned USC. So before I do that, help me out with this. Maybe you can help me with this. Troy, over the years I've done this, and I've done this a long, long time. I'm not sure why this is. Somebody might try to argue that, yeah, well, LA is a big market. But USC is very unique that in all the years that I've done this, the Trojan family has come on this show and interviewed as well as any other college or any other group of college football players ever in the NFL, and even while they were still in college. Do you have a theory on why that might be? They're amazing. The Trojans are amazing athletes to speak to, generally.
Interesting, yeah. it's funny. I guess we do also have, quite a few people out there in the media that were former players as well.
Right.
I'm sure it has a lot to do with the great educational system that we have there. I don't know. I can't say, you know, I will say Tim Tessalone and a lot of the great media people do a good job of taking care of athletes there and, you know, preparing them for interviews and whatnot. So definitely should give credit to them, but I think USC also does a good job of choosing great athletes, you know, that are great students as well.
Let's not forget about one of my favorite Trojans of all time, Troy, William McGinnis. That's a man's man.
Oh,
right there,
awesome.
William McGinnis.
Absolutely. So that's funny, too, because, like, you know, when I go back to USC, like, he culturally is a generation ahead of me. But then you look at somebody like him, like, he's one of those Trojan titans, man, that are, like, untouchable. And, like, just all around great person, great football player, of course, and legend, you know, of Southern California.
So, Troy, where does Ronnie Lott fit into all that then? If Willie's a Titan, and he is, how do you classify Ronnie Lott?
He's obviously part of even a much older generation now.
Right.
The great thing with Ronnie, man, is I used to talk to him before every game and in college. So to have that sort of experience where he would, you know, be like, hey, man, I know this is going to be your first start. Do your job. You know, play will come. You know, like, just hearing those sort of things from somebody like him to me was very special. And I had a coach, Dennis Thurman, at the time, who also played for USC, played for the Dallas Cowboys, and coached in the NFL. So he was also somebody who was in my ear every day because he was my coach, but connect me with, you know, older veterans as well.
And then, Troy, the last guy you mentioned, Anthony Munoz, I saw him also in Miami on Radio Row. He looks like a million bucks. I don't know if you saw this. He did the most amazing thing. I had Jorge Masvidal on my show. Munoz was shouting out to Jorge on Radio Row, telling him to kick Conor McGregor's ass. It was amazing.
Wow, that's amazing how these worlds come together, man, at these huge events.
Troy Polamalu is a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2020. Troy, I so value the relationship and the conversation. So good to have you back on, and I may have to do it again right around the time that you go in. That was so much fun.
Oh, pleasure's mine. Thank you so much.
Michael in the Bay. It's good to have you on. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
You got it. What's up?
So I know it's going to sound like a borderline conspiracy theory, and it is a little bit, but I don't think it's entirely impossible to think that Manfred's response is orchestrated in some way. You know, I certainly don't think that the cheating is part of that. I mean, the cheating is real. It's an attempt to get an advantage. But the response, I think there's something about it that is orchestrated. You know, we talk a lot about the problems with baseball, you know, and obviously one of the biggest problems is declining viewership and a younger generation that's not interested. And in the last couple of days, I mean, what are your thoughts? Do you think the viewership will go up or down based on Manfred's response?
Yeah, it's funny. I've got a thought or two on that. That's my thought.
No. You don't like that comment.
I don't like that comment. Not a very good comment.
Michael, you in no way didn't disrespect me. Didn't disrespect the program. So I'm going to try very hard not to disrespect you. But in regards to that take, I would not just hang up your phone. I would throw your phone away. Like, that's an all-time bad take. That you wouldn't put it by the commissioner to orchestrate his reaction because viewership is down and ratings are down, and now you've got people talking about the sport. You're not really going with any publicity is good publicity, are you? Because in this case, that would be legitimately dumb if that's what you're doing. All of baseball has been engulfed in this scandal for more than a month. Players are routinely dragging the commissioner. Fans have lost trust that the game is fair. The league has no vision whatsoever for getting out of this mess. But hey, Rome leads with it every day on his program. Hey, we're in the headlines. Hey, people are talking about us and looking at us. Now, that's an all-time bad take. I don't know. I mean, what are you saying? If that's what you're saying, that the commissioner may have orchestrated this, hey, why don't we take that a step further? Did the commissioner, in fact, teach the Astros how to cheat? Did the commissioner instruct the Astros to cheat? Because, and follow me on this, did the commissioner teach and tell the Astros how to cheat in 2017 for two reasons? One, it would be an amazing story because they had not won at all in a long, long, long time. And number two, not only would we get mileage out of that, but a few years later, we could blow the cover off of this and drag them and even me through it. And then everybody will talk about us all over again. Hey, Jose, this is what you do. I'm going to let you know, I'm going to give you a system whereby you know which pitch is coming. And it's going to happen at the most unbelievable time imaginable. And you are going to jump ship because you're going to know what's coming. They're going to put it on a tee for you. And you're going to hit a monumental bomb on the biggest stage of all. And because you're like 5'6", it's going to give hope to people all around the world. And it will be the best story ever. And we're going to ride that wave. And we're going to ride that wave for a few years. And then when that wave starts to kind of peter out, we're going to blow the top off it. Now, you can still keep your trophy. You can still keep all your money. I'm not going to rip that piece of metal from you. But we're going to flip it on its head. And then we're going to turn it over. And everybody's going to be pissed and talk about us. And it's going to be amazing. It's going to be great. Let's go to Tucson. John, good to have you. John, how are you?
Great, Jimmy.
Hey, John.
Here it is, opening day. I've got my ticket. Fourth inning, three batters were hit by pitch. Bases loaded. Joe Altuve gets to the batter's box, and all of a sudden, Altuve backs out of the batter's box, rolls his hand over like he wants to hear the signs all over again, and all of a sudden, boom.
No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
John. Hey, John.
Hey, John.
Time to see Mr. Rome.
Time to meet Mr. Rome.
Hey, John. Time to stop calling Mr. Rome. Hey, John. Time to never call Mr. Rome ever again.
Good night,